So my title, as I said today, is Free to Be Together. Now, that's quite a short passage that I've read to you. And this passage is going to be not only for this week, but Joe is going to preach on a little bit of this passage as well next week. So we're kind of splitting it between us. And there's not much to go around to start off with as it is. Joe's going to get the second bit next week, so I'm going to get the first bit. The bit I want to concentrate on is this: bear with each other. Okay? Bear with each other. Wes, can you just help me out if you've just got a little prop? I say a little prop at the back. I'm just going to get this chair as well, Paul. Is that all right if you just say that, mate? That's okay. Sorry the fact you've taken over my chair that quickly. I'm not worried. So, a few years ago, I had this. This is it. I don't know if you're sorry if you can't see it. About we can't get a chair as much as I know. This is my old PC computer, okay? Nice little side window on the side there. If anybody's close enough, you can kind of see a little bit about what's going on in there. Now, this computer, I've got a story, a true story to tell you about this computer. But I understand the fact that not everybody is as technically minded as me. So as I tell you a story, a sad story about this old computer, I'm going to tell it to you in two different ways. I'm going to tell you this story from the technical point of view, and I'm going to tell it you from the end user point of view. So for those of you who don't understand what that little cheer was about, if you're the kind of person that drives a car and you just want it to go, but you don't understand what goes on under the bonnet, you're an end user of a car. If you press a button on a computer and all you want it to do is turn on so you can type in a letter or send an email, but you haven't got a clue about what this is inside, you are an end user. An end user just wants it to work. Now, a few years ago, this is the technical bit, guys. So techies, any techies, get your techie heads on. This is the technical bit. I wanted to upgrade my motherboard. I wanted to upgrade it to one that would support a new state-of-the-art AMD processor because my current processor was only an old Pentium which required a different socket and it wouldn't run the latest games. And already I see the faces on some of you, which are very similar to Jo's face when I taught maths to her. It's the kind of face that she'll smile, she'll nod, she'll give me a few encouraging mms, but deep down, she's not bothered. And not only that, but she doesn't get it. But she's really good to me, and so she at least looks enthusiastic. So for you people, if that didn't make sense, here's the end user version. Okay, you know Lego. When you build a Lego house, what's the first thing you've got to start with? It's the base, isn't it? Everybody knows. That's universal. If you build a Lego house, you've got to start off with a base, and then you put all your nice little bricks on it, and then the picket fence around the front and a flat roof, and you put the people in it, and then you put the roof on so you can't see the people in it. But you've got to put a roof on anyway because you've got to do it properly, haven't you? The Lego base is like a motherboard. It's the bit that all the other bits stick onto. Now, some of you may know this already, but Liz used to be our cleaner. And when she used to come around and do cleaning, one of the many jobs that we gave her to do was ironing. And she's very good at ironing. Not only could she like iron three shirts at a time with one hand and she could hoover with the other hand whilst watching a box set of Friends at the same time. She was amazing. She could do all that. And Joe knew that she could give Liz that job to do and it would be done fantastically because Liz can multitask. If I am asked to iron a shirt, you might as well somebody to go out and buy a new one because it's going to be quicker because I am useless. Not only that, but I'll iron creases into it and then I'll blame somebody else because I can only do one thing at a time. Okay, so Liz can multitask. She's like the new processor. And I can only do one thing at a time very slowly and very badly. I am the old processor. So do you get that? Motherboard, Lego base. New processor, Liz. Old processor, me. Is this all right? Are we getting, you're all understanding. You're saying, why did my IT teacher never teach it like this? It's making so much more sense. Well, listen, Unfortunately, technical version. Unfortunately, my old AGP card was an ATI Rage Fury Max. It didn't appear to be compatible with my new motherboard, and whichever operating system I use, it hung when loading. End user version. Do you know pretty pictures on your computer screens of clouds and fluffy kittens? Yeah? The graphics card does that, okay? Now, it has little mini fans on like hair dryers, just like if somebody goes and blows on you like that, just to keep you cool. Nice hot summer's day like that, okay? Now, the graphics card, it would not be friends with the motherboard. They would not get on. They would not, big word, cooperate. Can you say cooperate? No, I'm just joking. Technical version. I thought it might have been the PSU issue because my unit only supplied 400 watts and the draw of the individual components was probably potentially higher. End user version, this didn't work. Don't get me started on the colour code of those wires. What were they thinking putting those together? Basically, the next bit of the story works on both levels. So I don't need to break this down for you. I found on the back of this computer a little switch that I'd never noticed before. Okay? Never noticed it. Didn't know what it did. But my computer wasn't working. So I thought, hey, there's a switch at the back I've never tried. I wonder if I switch it, it will start working. I remember a friend who knew something about computers telling me when I got my computer. He said, listen, when my computer kept crashing, he says, listen, don't worry about what buttons you press and what mouse buttons you click. He says, basically, ultimately, you can't hurt a computer. Whatever you do, don't worry. Do you know what? I'd beg to differ. Because when I flicked this switch, right, okay, did anybody go to a fireworks display this week at all? Hands up if you went to any kind of fireworks display. Okay, hands down. Your fireworks display has nothing on what happened to my computer when I flicked this switch at the back. There was basically a huge bang, a huge flash, bits of computer confetti showered all over the room, and the computer stopped doing anything. I mean, it was like dodo dead. It was just completely kaput. And to cut a long story short, it took me over 3 weeks of a lot of time and a heck of a lot more money to put back into the computer to actually get all the little individual bits in that computer to start cooperating, to start getting on together so that it would work and actually do the job that was it was intended to do. I want to read you from 1 Peter 2, just verses 4 and 5. Some of you may have heard these couple of verses before. It says this: come to Christ, who is the living cornerstone of God's temple. He was rejected by the people, but he is precious to God who chose him. And now God is building you, that's you, me and you, all of us, as living stones into his spiritual temple. If you think the potential for things going wrong in modern electrical components is quite high, that ain't got nothing on the church. You see, the church is made up of living stones. That's breathing, feeling, emotional stones that get put together. God never intended the church just to be made up of the one stone, Jesus. And a lot of people get this a little bit wrong. Yes, Jesus is the cornerstone of the church. He's the stone which we as Christians take all our measurements from. But if the church was only intended to be built of one living cornerstone surrounded by dead stones, let me tell you, it wouldn't be God's best plan for this world. Because God wants the church to be made of living, breathing stones that are built around the one living cornerstone, which is Jesus. You don't need to turn to it. There's a very good passage, very short passage in Psalm 92, 12, 13. It says this. It says, but the godly will flourish like palm trees and they'll grow strong like the cedars of Lebanon, for they are transplanted into the Lord's own house. They flourish in the courts of God. And I find that passage very interesting, because basically what it's saying is this. It's saying that God is trying to get us all to flourish by putting us all together with other flourishing living people. Now, he didn't need to say that. He could have said, if you want to be a living stone, it's good enough for you to have a relationship directly with me, and that's good enough. And of course, if that's all available to you, if you're on a desert island somewhere and the best you can do is have a relationship with the one living stone, then fair dues to you. But God's plan is to say, I want you to be part of a living, breathing, organic building with other living stones, and that is how I intend you to thrive. So the people that God's put you with in church, they're the people that God intends to be able to help you have prosperity, to help you thrive, to help you to grow, to help you to flourish. And then surely the opposite is true, because then if you cut yourself off from those kind of people, then you're going to have problems. If you cut off relationships, you're cutting off one of the main sources of the ways that God brings blessings to you. Did you know that, church? So, if we're talking about living stones, how do we know if something is living? How do we know if something is alive? Well, here I need to draw upon my historical knowledge of GCSE biology. I hope that doesn't fill you with dread too much. I'm going to keep it simple. When I was at school, we were told that if something was alive, it had to have 7 different characteristics. And there was an acronym, which was Mr. Niger. Anybody ever heard of Mr. Niger? That's just my school, obviously. Mr. Niger had 7 letters which stood for these 7 characteristics. M is movement. R is respiration. N is nutrition. I is irritability. G is growth. E is excretion. And R is reproduction. Those 7 things need to be present for something to scientifically be classed as alive. So if I wanted to decide if this bottle of water is alive or not, I've got to start going through those 7 principles. I've got to start saying, okay, number 1, is it moving? No, it's dead. Okay, so that's not alive. Falls at the first hurdle. But all 7 of them need to be there. I just want to go through these 7 principles of how something can be alive and apply it to us as living stones. Is that okay, church? Okay, so number one is movement. Everybody say movement. Well done, your lips just moved. You must be alive. Our kids, if they have a nightmare at the moment, they'll either shout us from the bedroom, or what is equally likely is they'll come into our bedroom and say, Mummy, Daddy, I've had a bad dream. Can I get in bed? Now, Caitlin, who's the older of our two, who's 7, if she gets in bed, she is just like, there's an electric current going through all the time. She can't stay still. There's arms and legs and knees and headbutts and everything. She will not lie still. Whereas if Ollie comes in, Ollie, now I think I'd best describe him as he's kind of like a coiled cobra or a loaded mousetrap. He'll get in bed and he'll lie really still and you think, that's okay, he's calming down, he's gone to sleep, and you just turn over and all of a sudden you get a whack and you wake up with a black eye in the morning. He is lethal. I mean, he's not a small lad for his age. And here's what I've realised. When I am trying to get to sleep in bed, do you know what I want going on around me? Nothing! I want still, I want calm, I want peace. Now, if you are in a church, you are surrounded by a bunch of other living stones. And they're all moving, and they're wriggling, and they're shaking, and they're kind of not being still. Now, if you, as a living stone, I thought, I don't like all this move. I just want to be still. I don't want to move. I don't want anybody else around me moving. It's uncomfortable. There's only two ways I know you can go to a church where you can be surrounded with other still stones. You either go to a church that's asleep or you go to a church that's dead. And I don't want to be part of either. I want to be in a church where things are moving, because how many of you know this? God is drawn to movement. If God sees you moving, he goes, oh, wait a minute. There's somebody who's moving. There's somebody who's trying to go there. There's somebody who's trying. I will partner with them and I will move along with them. Have you ever been to a football match where somebody scored? Does everybody stand still? There's a huge surge as everybody cheers, and as one accord, they'll go, yes! And there may be a bit of jumping and a bit of crowd surfing before the stewards get you, because health and safety comes first. And because everybody's moving, nobody minds. Have you ever been to a disco, a wedding, and all generations are on the dance floor? So your kids are kind of freaking out a bit, but they don't really know how to dance. And your dad, he doesn't really know how to dance either, and he's freaking out in a completely different way. And you're thinking, I'm embarrassed by them, but they're quite our joint, our standard. But everybody's moving, and nobody minds because everybody's moving. You might have your own slight different style, but if you are in a bunch of moving people, you don't care that people are moving because you're moving too. If you want to exhibit the first sign of life as a living stone, you have got to show some kind of motion. Point number two, respiration. Everybody say respiration? You still with me? Thank you very much. Respiration is this. It's the exchange of gases between organisms and their environment. So what is the environment of organisms? Well, basically, pretty much predominantly for most, not all, but for most, it's the air. It's the air around. It's the same air that you and I live and breathe in and out. Then the thing about air is most of it is pointless to us. Yes, there's a bit of air that's important. It's called oxygen. Oxygen's quite useful. We use it when we respire. But the rest of it, well, there's a bit of carbon dioxide in there. Well, that's stuff that we try and get rid of when we breathe out. We don't really need that. And there's a very large amount, 4/5 of it, is this gas called nitrogen. Nitrogen, well, it doesn't do us any good. It doesn't do us any harm. We don't need it. And then there's a little bit of those stuff that, you know, they're always telling us on the news shouldn't be there. Bit of pollution, bit of your carbon monoxide, bit of your poisonous gases that come out from car exhaust. You know, it's all mixed up there in this cocktail of stuff that we call air. So if I'm going to respire, I've got to take all of that in. Now, let me tell you something. If I am a healthy organism, I do that naturally. I take in the bits that I need. I kick out and breathe back out the bits that I don't need. And I just get on with doing other stuff. You know, if you talk to the people in the medical profession, they'll tell you that the worst way to breathe is to try and take control over your breathing. So when you're asleep, you're not taking control over your breathing. Your body does it naturally. It takes in the bits that it needs and it kicks out the bits that it doesn't want, and it does it perfectly well. But if I say to you, okay, right now, everybody take control of your breathing. After three, you're all going to breathe in, and then after, hold that and then breathe. And you start trying to take control of it. That is a very, very ineffective way to take in the air for your respiration. So the most effective way of breathing is to let it happen automatically. And do you know what? The sign of a healthy living stone is if you can take in what you need from the environment, but you can leave alone the stuff that will do you harm or is ineffective to you. And you can train yourself as a Christian to do that naturally in the background while you get on with other things. Now, yes, there may be a bit of training. You know, when a newborn baby's born, if it ain't breathing, what do? You give it a slap. I love kids. Can't beat them. It's against the law. Yeah. You can edit that one from the podcast. That was bad, wasn't it? You may have heard it said that as Christians we need to be in the world, but not of the world. Now, that's referring to something that Jesus said in John 17. The way to respire correctly isn't to say this, oh, do you know what? I've just discovered what there is in air. There's that stuff called carbon monoxide. That's a bit poisonous, isn't it? And do you know what? There's all that nitrogen in it, and that's pointless to me. That doesn't do me any good at all. I mean, I've got nothing against nitrogen. It's just that I don't need it. And say, oh, do you know what? I'm going to do without air from now on. It's just too much of a faff taking it in. There's all that stuff in it that I don't want anything to do with. Yeah, there's a little bit that's good for me, but it's only a fifth of it. If you think that's a good way to respire, try it for a couple of hours. Come back, tell me, let me know how you got on. Do without air for 2 hours. Because, of course, it doesn't work that way. And if you're going to be in the world but not of the world, there's bits of the world that you've got to get involved with. You've got to get your hands dirty. You've got to get out there. It's very good to have an occupation out in the world that's not actually to do with the church. No offense to people who are working in the church. But you know, it's quite often by our vocation and our job that God uses us in those situations, because sometimes the only way that people in those jobs that you work with are going to find anything out about Jesus is through you. So you've got to be in the world to do something to help change the world. Make sure that you have something that gets you involved in the world. Because if all you're doing is bunkering down, waiting for God's mothership to take you home, you're not being very effective as a living stone. Number three is nutrition. Everybody say nutrition. Nutrition, this is easy. This is God's word. Now, God's word. Where do I go with this point? Because basically, God's word, you could spend the rest of your life studying it, the rest of your life preaching about it, and you'd probably still not get to the end of it. When I look at God's word, when I look at the Bible, I read it from the perspective that it's true. I believe it's authoritative. I believe it's inspired, infallible, unbreakable, sufficient. And I could go through all of those things with you in a preach. And I could say, and that's why I believe that. And I believe that Jesus quoted scriptures. And you know, he valued them and he understood that they were the inspired. But I'm not going to go down that route. Because today we're talking about living stones, living with other living stones. I want to tell you something about when you read the Bible, not what does it mean. Not what does it mean. We do small bite-sized chunks of that every week with you in church. I want to put this question to you. When you read the Bible, how do you know, or how do you make sense of it? How do you know who it was written for? How do you know who it was written for? Because you know what? When you're reading the Bible, author intentions are key. Who they were writing it for makes a huge difference as to how you interpret it and understand it and take it in. The majority of the Bible was not intended to be one big storybook. You know, the English novel only came into being approximately 300 years ago. Before that, they didn't have novels and storybooks. The kind of stuff they read were either books of law or maybe poetry or plays. There wasn't the same kind of culture we have these days of downloading something on your Kindle or your iPad and reading a book. And so the older that something is and the longer ago it was when you read it, the harder it can be to put yourself in the right mindset to understand the rules and the laws and the traditions of the time so that it actually makes sense to you. If I read a modern day newspaper, I get what that newspaper means when it says internet. I understand the modern day events when it says things like tsunami or 9/11 or Brexit. I get that, and so do you, because you live in this era. But if you go back to when the Bible was written, which is, you know, anywhere between 1900 years and 3000 years ago, to give or take. If you don't understand, or was it written for a church in Corinth, or was it written for, you know, the Jewish nation as they were coming out of exile through Egypt? The people who it was written for is absolutely key in your interpretation of the book or the passage that you are reading. In the book of Ruth, which is a great story, you can actually read the book of Ruth like a story start to finish. Really good stuff in it. And there's a point in there where, to seal a deal, a couple of people swap a sandal. I don't know about you, I haven't seen many people swapping a sandal to seal a deal. We tend to shake hands. If you look in Genesis, one guy goes, put your hand under my thigh. and that will seal the deal. Imagine being sat next to somebody on a bus. You're having a chat and you agree on something. Yeah, yeah, I agree. Just put your hand under my thigh. We'll agree on it. Because it was written for a completely different audience, in a completely different culture, with a completely different mindset. So guys, if you want to get a bit of nutrition, if you want to understand the Word of God a bit better, I would encourage you to do a little bit of research in understanding who the original author intended it to be written for. Because author intentions are key. Why coming to church is so important together. I have heard some weird and wacky interpretations of scriptures and Bible verses, and you know what? Quite often they're from people who were Christians, but they've taken themselves outside the context of a church, outside of other people living stones, and they come up with their own strange interpretation that even your pet goldfish could tell you doesn't make sense, and yet they're saying, no, that's it, between me and God, that's what the scriptures mean. That's why going to things like Connect Group is so helpful, because you've got a safe environment where you can sit down and talk about, what does this mean? Who wrote this? Well, I've never really got that. What do you think? It stops you coming up with weird and wacky ideas about what the scriptures mean. If you are living stones, study the scriptures together. It's a safe environment. Yes, study your Bible on your own. Yes, familiarize yourself with it. But coming together as a church, hey, there ain't no substitute for that. Number four, irritability. This, before you jump to any conclusions about irritability in a church, okay? This means the ability of organisms to respond to stimuli, to respond to what's going on around you. So if somebody pokes you, you react and go, ah, why did you poke me? It's stimuli. If you hear something, see your normal senses, basically, are the stimuli that you may respond to. And you know, as living stones, we got to get good at reacting. Not just reacting, but reacting right. I heard somebody preach once and he said, listen, every good Christian should have a complaint. And again, before you'll start moaning at me saying, you're talking too loud, Matt. Get on with it. Get to the point. It's not that kind of complaint. The complaint I'm talking about is the kind of complaint that somebody in this church had when they said, I don't think it's right that people can't afford to clothe their children to go to school. It's so expensive. It was a complaint. It started off as a complaint. I don't think that's right. I know we've got poor families. I tell you what, let's do something about that. Wouldn't it be a good idea if within this church we opened up a clothing bank? Hey, there's a great complaint. I had a complaint. For a while, I was really frustrated we didn't have a church website. I was going, this can't be right. In a modern era of technology, people who are coming to this area or people who live in land can't even find out about us by typing our name in Google. I had a complaint. I didn't just sit back and do nothing about it. I went to a man who could do something about it. And James, as you visited our website, has done a phenomenal job getting our website so unbelievably professional. You don't believe me? Look at some of the dross out there for some of the websites. It was a complaint, which I only knew what my small part to play in was. I knew that something needed to be done, but it was a positive complaint because I was responding and reacting to the world around me. If you can respond, if you can prove that level of irritability, then you are proving that you are a living stone church. Number five. Growth. We're doing well so far, so let's try it. Everybody say growth. Yes, I like it. You've got to commit to grow as a Christian. You got to. Let me ask you a question. Are you, as a Christian, don't mean physically now, don't get me wrong, are you any bigger than you were 6 months ago? Or 5 years ago? Or 10 years ago? I don't know how long you've been saved. But if you are a Christian and you are walking with God, then you should be growing in a way that you should be getting stronger and wiser and further on with this walk with God. Or do you feel like maybe you're stuck in traffic? Do you feel like you're not getting anywhere, making no progress? You're fighting the same battles? You're struggling with the same temptations? You know, are you just bunkered down and you're not risking anything? There's a really good parable that Jesus told. They're all really good, but I like this one, the parable of the talents, about this master who gives certain amounts of money to all his servants, and then he clears off for a bit, and he says, do something good with that money. And there's some servants that do a load with what they've got, and they invest it, they increase it. And when the master comes back, he's really impressed with the ones who've done something and grown the amount of money that they've given. Do you know what he says to the guy who buried his money and did nothing with it? Let me give you a clue. He wasn't impressed. He did not say, oh, well done. You kept that amount of money exactly the same size as it was before I left. You buried it in the ground. You remembered where you buried it. You did a treasure map. You put X marks a spot. And you dug it up again when I came back. No, he says, you could have at least put it in a bank. You could have at least risked the interest rates a great bit. You could have at least done something. That I put in you, that I gave you, and you're telling me you did nothing? We as living stones all need to be committed to grow as living stones. Sometimes the best way to grow is to get your hands dirty, just to use the analogy of a farmer might use. You just need to muck in, get a bit of manure, get a bit of compost, get the seed to grow. You just need to get a bit dirty. Commit yourself to grow. It's a sign of life. It's a sign that you are alive. I'm going to do the last 2 points in reverse order, if that's okay, just so you think I haven't forgotten. So point number 6, everybody say reproduction. Reproduction. Where do I go with this reproduction? Oh, my word. Okay, well, if you look in my biology textbook, it says it's the ability of a living organism to make copies of itself. So let's keep it simple. A living organism making copies of itself. You know, back in the 80s, show my age a little bit, there was this Christian artist, this Christian musician, a guy called Steve Taylor. You probably never heard of him. But he used to write quite controversial song lyrics. And one of the songs that he wrote was this song called I Want to Be a Clone. And me and my brother used to laugh about it being a stupid title. I want to be a clone? What's that talking about? But I actually at one point went away and read the words on the LP album. Do you remember that when you used to get records and you used to print the words on the album sleeves? Remember that? Good times then, weren't they? Isn't that great? You could read the words. Anyway, I read the words and I understood a bit more about what I Want to Be a Clone was all about. It's all about this. In a church, churches are really bad at, when somebody gets saved and come into a church, letting that person be themselves as an individual. What they actually try and do is impose the rules and the regulations, and basically everybody in the church has to behave the same, dress the same, act the same, say the same things. There is no room for individuality. You know, God never wanted that for you as a living stone. He did not want a church of clones. He did not want you to force to be losing that uniqueness, that individuality that he put in you. From the point of conception, that's you. That's who he made you to be a clone. Hey, come on. You know, I want my kids, don't get me wrong, I want my kids to pick out some of the positive, good aspects of me, but do I want them to grow up to be like me? Exactly. Like a clone. Like, I mean, have you seen Austin Powers? Dr. Evil and Mini-Me? Really? Have you seen that?
Dr. Evil. Hot magma.
Everybody say hot mac. No, don't say hot. I don't want that. I don't want that. I don't want to be sat next to people who are clones of me in a church. And I don't think God is going to be that impressed if that's what we impose on other people. So in my experience, positive, thriving churches should be full of people that are basically a cross-section of your community. Should be a bit like Noah's Ark, really. Noah's Ark was a cross-section of animals from the world, wasn't it? So a church should be made up of like people like giraffes and hyenas and guinea pigs and monkeys. You're all thinking which one you are now, right? Are you thinking what the person next to you is? I don't know. A church should be made up of completely different people. Otherwise, it's not serving the community it was intended to be part of. So as a church, when we reproduce, guys, can I encourage you? Don't impose cloneliness on some new people that come to the church. Allow them to be who God intended them to be. And if you are the kind of person that feels like all you need to do is conform and be a clone, maybe this is your opportunity to think as well again. Yes, we want to reproduce. Yes, we want to grow as a church. We want to introduce new people. But we were never intended all to be the same. And here's my last point. And if you thought reproduction was difficult, to think of something for, 7 is excretion. Everybody say excretion. We're in a church. You've got to keep this clean. Keep this U certificate for you. Excretion. Excretion, well, it sounds a little bit risky, but all it is your body getting rid of its waste products that it doesn't need. In fact, your kidneys, which do one of the jobs of helping your blood and your body stay clean. Apparently, I checked this out, if your kidneys shut down, if your kidneys stop working, you've got between 1 and 3 weeks of life left. After that, you're dead. Because quite literally, unless there's some medical intervention, your body will poison itself. Excretion is just getting rid of what you need to get rid of in your life. I know that probably every single person who's sat in this room now has been through some stuff. I'm pretty sure we've all got some stuff in our life that we need to try and get rid of. It's called sin. We've all got it. We've all got hard situations, difficult situations that we are going through. And I could say to you now for my last point, hey, listen, guys, it's important that you all now work through some of this stuff yourself. I could. Of course I could. That would be a perfectly valid point. Nobody would disagree with me, at least I hope not. I want to come at it from a different angle. Because we're talking about living stones, living with other living stones. How do you respond when somebody next to you or near to you is trying to go through some stuff? What's your part to play in that? I want to finish with a true short story for you. I'm going to call this guy Mark. A few years ago, I met this guy called Mark in Louth. He was homeless. He didn't really have any clothes under what he was wearing. He certainly didn't have any money. And I got chatting to him for an hour or two. Had some quite good conversations. He told me a bit about his history, how he'd ended up where he was. And I felt bad about that for him. And so I said, listen, let me get you something to eat. Let me get you a hot drink because it wasn't warm. Let me take you to a shop. Let me just buy you something because I wasn't sure what he'd do with the money if I just gave it him. So I physically walked to the shop with him and I got him some stuff. And I said, listen, and there's a little bit of change there. Keep the change because I'm sure that will come in useful. And he thanked me. I said, listen, I'm really sorry. I've nowhere to put you up. I can't find somewhere for you to live. I can't solve your job problems. I can't solve all your situations in life. But I can do these little bits for you. And if you find yourself at a loose end later on this evening, come back, find me. I'll be here. To cut a long story short, this guy, Mark, well, he broke into several buildings and he stole from me and other people that I knew and he got caught by the police and sent away to prison for 3 years. And you know, that could have been the end of it for me. I could have said, well, got him a cup of tea, got him some food, got him a sandwich, bought him some stuff from the shop, lent him an ear for 2 hours. And I decided that on this occasion that wasn't enough. And I remember spending weeks and weeks trying to follow up what had happened to him. Because I didn't know that same night what had happened to him. It was only quite a long time later. And I don't know if any of you know this, but if somebody's committed a crime against you, you have the right to go to a post-restorative justice officer. There's somebody who can arrange a face-to-face meeting with the person who committed the offence against you. And it doesn't always work, and sometimes the crime's too serious, and sometimes the perpetrator declines and says, no, I don't want to see them, it's too harrowing, it's too upsetting. But on this occasion, I made these phone calls and somebody led me to somebody else and I phoned them and they said, well, I don't know, but try this person. And eventually, I managed to arrange the meeting with this guy, Mark. I remember driving to Lincoln because that's the prison he was in. I wasn't allowed to go into my own. I had to go in with two of these officers, two of these people that arranged this meeting for me. And they kind of walked either side of me. And as we went into this prison, I'd never been in a prison in my life. It was surreal. It was weird. Totally different environment to anything that I'd experienced before. And you had to go through, you know, the security checks, and they've got these big doorways that, and you've got to empty your pockets and metal detectors. And I'm just thinking, what am I doing here? This isn't me. I work in a school. You might think a school's a bit like that. It's not, trust me. Even secondary school. And they took me into this small office, and there's this huge table in the middle that almost like divides this office into two. And I come in one door with these two officers, and we sit down in our chairs. And in an opposite corner, there's this other door which goes directly to the prison wing where there's hundreds of inmates. I can hear them. I'm sure the door is thick. I hope it was thick. And I can hear them on the other side. And then in comes this prison officer escorting Mark in. And Mark sits down on the other side of the table. And I'm looking at him intently, and I can see he's shaking. He's shaking slightly. To be honest, so am I. And these meetings have to be very, very clearly structured so they don't get out of hand. Because remember, you're in a prison. And you're dealing with offenders. And so they say, one of the officers at my side says, okay, Mark, this is your turn. Can you tell Matthew about the offence that you committed about him? And so off Mark goes, and he tells me this whole story. It wasn't anything personal, he says. It was a crime of opportunity. It was to feed a drugs habit. And he starts going through all these reasons about where he was and why he was there and how all the circumstances in his life had led to that. And it was everybody else's fault, it seemed. And there were a lot of people to blame. And his family was to blame. And society was to blame. And the people he'd been hanging around were to blame. And he was there now. And he was very sorry. He didn't want to be there. He's nearly my age. He says, and look at me now, he says. I don't really know what I do from now on. He says, but I'm sorry. And then the officer next to me says, okay, Matthew, now it's your turn. Would you like to say to Mark what you want to say? And so I said, Mark, I think you're an idiot. I think you've got to this situation in life, you're blaming a lot of other people, and I offered him one or two explanations just to really what I thought was the reasons why he'd ended up where he was. I said, so I want to say a few things to you. I said, first of all, if you want someone to write to you in prison, I will write to you. I said, secondly, if you find yourself short of stuff you need, if you've not got clothes or something like that, you want some books to read, there's something you feel that I can help you with on the outside, you let me know, and I'll make sure you get it. And I said, and the third thing is this. I said, when you get out of prison, if you want to meet up with somebody, if you need someone to talk to when you get out, rather than as so many, I saw the statistics on the news this week, and they're saying at the prison, people who come out of the system, you know, 50% reoffend. I said, if you want to talk to somebody because you feel that that will help you stay out of trouble, when you get out of prison, you contact me. And if I can, I will come visit you. I said, and the last thing is this. I said, I don't know if you get this. I said, I don't know what your background is. I don't know if you're going to church. I said, I want you to know I forgive you for stealing from me. And you can see Martin, he's confused, and he starts to talk to me, and he's stuttering, and he goes, I don't get it. Why? Why? He says, well, I've only done you wrong. Why would you do that? I said, call it a hunch. I said, my wife and I have just adopted. I use this as an example to him. I said, my wife and I have just adopted through a Christian Partners in Africa scheme. There's a little girl that lives in Africa, and we've adopted her. We pay money. I said, I can't solve all the problems in Africa, but I can make a difference for that one girl. I said, I can't help all the other inmates who are through that wall in that prison there that you have to mix with every day. I said, but I might be able to make a difference with you, one person. My question is this. Is there at least just one person you can help get through some stuff? Just one person? Maybe somebody in here, because we're all living stones at the end of the day. I guarantee you this. You as a living stone in your position in this building, which we call the church, which God is building, but you're part of it. You as a living stone, I guarantee that every living stone around you is going through something. And if you go out into the wider world, you'll find a lot more. Who can you help get through some stuff? You know, not everybody is called to be an evangelist, but everybody is called to be a witness. Everybody is called by God as a living stone. For God's sake, we are all called to witness. And sometimes we witness to other living stones. Our lifestyle, the way that we live, the way that we are, the way that we help other people is a sign that we are trying. We are trying, and sometimes in our own clumsy, unique ways, we are trying to be there for other people. And so there you are, church. Ask Mr. Niger. You want to be alive? You want to be a living stone, as God intended? You got seven things to work on. We are free to be together, which means we do, and I repeat, we do need to bear with one another. You struggle getting on with people. You're not alone. They did a survey. I remember reading the results of this survey. What were the three top fears of people? And time again, the three top fears were public speaking, death, and a room full of strangers. So if you feel a bit awkward approaching, talking, sharing, spending time with people that usually every Sunday you only sit three rows away from, you're not alone. There's a world full of fearful people of that. I want you to understand that it's God's plan for you to thrive in a living church. I want you to understand that the only alternative to being alive is to not be alive. I wouldn't wish that on anybody. Not in a physical sense, but not in the spiritual sense either. I want to live my life with other living stones. And all I'll say is this. I hope you do too. I hope with every fiber of my being, I hope you want to live with other living stones. Because the church is God's best plan. It's his only plan. No plan B in the wings. No cavalry coming over the hill. We are it. You are it. And so as a church with the one living stone, but made up as living, breathing stones, we've got to bear with each other. We've got to support each other. We've got to help each other. We've got to commit to grow. And I hope for your sake, for the church's sake, for God's sake, you're willing to commit yourself to grow. God bless you, church. Thank you very much.